Podcast Episode Number 31.
On this show, I talked to columnist Amy Chavez about her book, Japan Sunny Side Up, and she tells us what's it like to live on a Japanese island with a population of less than 700 people. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tokyo Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Joe. And on today's show, I'll be talking to Miss Amy Chavez, who has been living in Japan here for many, many years. And she writes a column for the Japan Times, as well as the Huffington Post website. What's interesting about Amy is that she lives on an island called, Shiraishi Island, which is in the Inland Sea of Japan. And what's particularly interesting about her island is that it has a population of 700 people. Now, that's really interesting because, you know, many times when you think of Japan, you think of like the packed trains of Tokyo and, you know, you just see these masses of people. But she lives on an island that has, I think she told me she has it has one bar and one grocery store that's got like four shelves in it or something like that. But it's got a population of 700 people. And Amy lives down there, and I believe actually she's the owner of the one bar that's down there, the Moo Bar, I believe it's called. And she writes a column for the Japan Times called Japan Light. And her column takes a humorous look at all the different and funny things here in Japan. So I'll be talking to Amy about her latest book called Japan Funny Side Up a little bit later on in the show. I am pleased to welcome back to the show Brad from 25cafes.com. 25cafes is your travel guide to 100% free cafes in Japan. And Brad joins us to give us his latest review from Japan. Hey, Brad, welcome to Tokyo Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you got for us this week?
Well, today I'm going to talk about La Maison du Chocolat Paris. It's a chocolate cafe in Omotesando.
Oh, yeah.
So Omotesando is a really nice kind of trendy area. It's right next to Harajuku. So you can actually walk to Omotesando from Harajuku if you're in the area, or just get a train directly to Omotesando station.
Right.
So this cafe, it's a really interesting kind of idea. It's instead of actually focusing on coffee and regular food, its main focus is the chocolate. So this company is actually from Paris. It is a legitimate, apparently my friends tell me, a very, very famous, respectable brand of chocolates. So if you are into chocolates, like brand name chocolates, this is the place for you. Though, personally, I just like Cadbury. So for me, all of it was like, oh, wow, chocolates in a box, very expensive prices.
Right.
So, yeah, so it will, like, your level of wowness will depend on who you are, I guess. But the ground floor has the actual chocolate store. And upstairs is a cafe. Be warned, though, it doesn't really open until 11 a.m. So if you get there early, just feel free to walk around like we did and enjoy some of the shops in the area.
Right.
So the cafe is actually really, really nice. It is very relaxing, and it's actually a great place for people watching, as the top floor has almost completely window walls to sit next to.
And Omotesando is a very fashionable, trendy part of Tokyo, is that right?
It is. It's a very kind of, I would say, there are more international areas in Tokyo, such as Roppongi or Azabujuban.
Right.
But this is very, very international, very kind of upper class. There's a lot of kind of very expensive fashion label stores in the area, and a lot of import stores. And a lot of the people that would kind of shop in this area probably do have quite a bit of money, or like to pretend that they do.
Right. By eating fancy chocolate.
Exactly. So actually, it's really interesting. Like, we went in there, and like the other kind of middle-aged, like 40, 50-year-old women were in there with like wearing like their fur scarves and coats and all that. And we felt a bit richer just sitting there.
Right.
But it's surprisingly, the cost of the food in the cafe floor is actually quite affordable. The regular meal cost us around 800 yen, which is actually quite cheap for an outing.
What's the food that's available in the cafe?
So there is a warning. Don't go here. If you're after an actual meal, if you're feeling hungry, we basically got hot chocolate and a kind of a citrusy pound cake,
right,
or chocolate brownie. That's really the most that you'll really be getting here. So it's great to catch up with friends or maybe have a little drink before you go elsewhere.
Right.
But don't go here if you're after a big meal.
Good place for a quick dessert.
Exactly. But having said that, though, it was a really enjoyable experience. Definitely something different in Tokyo, where most cafes are very much purely chocolate or even maybe a tea. Sitting down and having hot chocolate, something you might not really think about. So it's great for if you want to try something different.
Right, right. It's also interesting, too, that the menu is in Japanese, English, and French.
Yeah, well, the menus are in Japanese and French, but the waitresses, some of them speak a little bit of English, and you can kind of guesstimate with the French on the menu.
Do they speak French?
No, they don't. The staff are very much Japanese. So I don't know. We didn't try speaking French to them, as we can't, but you never, never know.
Right.
But they do definitely try to keep, I think, the brand quality from the original French stores.
Right.
So, and it definitely does feel very, very good quality. It is 100% no smoking, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
The service was very, very good. And the quality, I'm guessing because I'm not a chocolate expert, but the quality did seem rather, rather impressive. Though I would have to say that if you do like to drink cocoa every now and then or hot chocolate yourself at home, I like mine very, very black. And even though I ordered the dark chocolate, hot chocolate, I did actually find it a lot lighter than I would have liked.
Right. Okay.
But overall, a very, very fun experience and maybe a good place for a date.
Right, right. Cool. Well, if people want to find out more about La Maison du Chocolat Paris, visit 25cafes.com. And thanks, Brad. Thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
I am pleased today to welcome Ms. Amy Chavez, who is a longtime resident of Japan and a columnist for the Japan Times and Huffington Post. Her column, Japan Light, has been published since 1997 and takes a humorous look at the differences between Western and Japanese cultures. Her latest book, Japan Funny Side Up, is a funny and insightful guide that gives valuable insights into the mysterious and sometimes strange aspects of Japanese culture and society. Welcome, Amy, to Tokyo Podcast.
Thank you very much, Anthony. Happy to be here.
Now, I am very interested in when I read your book, because there are many guidebooks available for Japan, but none of them are kind of as, shall we say, quirky as your
Thank
book.
You. I take that as a compliment.
Definitely it was. Where did the idea for this book come from, to do it in this kind of different style?
It was a development. I kind of wanted to, I'd been in Japan already 5 years at the time I wrote it, and I had written quite a few columns for the Japan Times by then, and I wanted to put something together that would show some of the sides of the culture that, you know, guidebooks just can't delve into. The things about the everyday life and things, I mean, guidebooks are great, but they have to be pretty objective. So I wanted to get in deeper and ask some questions such as, why is Japan this way? Like, we all know certain things, like that they love Hello Kitty and cute things, but why is this? Where does it come from? So I started choosing some columns that I thought would fit into answering these questions, and also I put together some stuff about teaching in Japan and living in Japan and visiting in Japan. And it was originally published as Guidebook to Japan, What the Other Guidebooks Won't Tell You, and was put out by a publisher in the States. And then when it went out of print and I got the copyright back, I decided to put it up as an ebook on Amazon.com. And then what I did is I cut it down, because it's a bit long for an ebook at 400 pages. And I put... I took out some of the parts on the teaching and stuff and tried to make it a little bit more for the general traveler.
Yeah, that's one of the things I found very interesting about your book was all the links to other people's websites and Twitter feeds and all that kind of stuff. You don't see that very often in guidebooks. So in some ways, your book is kind of like it's a good starter kit. It's like an online starter kit for getting going in Japan because it gives you this wealth of information that you can find online in one ebook.
Yeah. So, but what I wanted to do with it too, one of my main goals and what took all the time was I wanted to give people further resources where they could go to find out more about Japan. And there are so many people out there who have great blogs on Japan, you know, such as Surviving Japan with Ashley.
Right.
And I mean, there are tons of people out there that are doing such good things and they don't have a venue other than themselves for this stuff. So I spent a lot of time looking and finding the really good stuff. Japan Probe, Japan Zone, those blogs that you continuously go back to because what they're writing is really good, they're writing well, and they're giving you parts of Japan that you know no one else is talking about. So I wanted it to be kind of an all-encompassing look at Japan. There are even some controversial URLs in there, which I think is fine. And then, as well, I've put in, you know, people's Twitter feeds and Facebooks that I think are interesting. I have recommended certain books that people read if they're interested in a certain aspect of Japan. So it's more of a niche market on those books, whether it be Japanese castles or, you know, or just our cartoons or, you know, things like that that are maybe a little bit not in the mainstream. And when I say cartoons, I'm not talking about anime and manga. I'm talking about, like, mascots, things like that, which are really, you know, so Japanese.
Right.
And but quirky and fun and really insights into the culture. And then I put in a lot of language, just fun language that people are going to need. Where's the toilet? Where's the Western toilet?
Right.
Rather than the Japanese toilet. And, you know, just things that might be useful, but also kind of funny too, because I know a lot of, I mean, even when people of two either cultures or countries don't speak the same language, humor is always something that's universal. So if they can say something funny in Japanese, then that's going to, you know, really kind of give them a break in into a conversation with someone. And the Japanese have a great sense of humor. They love to laugh. And there's nothing funnier to them than two people who can't speak the same language, as I'm sure you've noticed.
You mentioned something a little bit a few minutes ago where you said you tried to explain the why of how things happen in Japan. You know, for example, one of your columns is one of the chapters is why do Japanese people shuffle their feet?
Yeah.
And small things like that. And, you know, that got me thinking that, you know, you've been here a long time. You've been here 17 years, is that correct?
Yeah.
Written a column for many, many years, have a great insight into Japanese culture. And I'm sure a question that sits on the minds of many people who've never been to Japan, but have seen videos on YouTube or other websites about Japan, and I'm sure the question that they have is, why does Japan produce so much weird stuff?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you said you got some controversial links in your book, and I was looking through some of them the other day, some videos about, you know, some Japanese people just doing some weird stuff. And why do you think that is? Why do you think so much strange stuff just seem to be just made for the internet, though,
yeah,
comes from Japan?
Well, first of all, I think that you can find it in a lot of places, not just Japan. You know,
Japan
even
seems to dominate this field of weird internet videos.
Well, I think it's because Japan's easy to pick on. When we don't understand why people do things because the culture's so different, you could, like, go, I mean, look at America and crime. I'm sure crime isn't nearly as bad as it's made out to be.
Right.
But that's our thing. America's dangerous. That's what the world knows. And, you know, we have all these, you know, these movies and shows and that all, you know, focus on crime. I mean, we're obsessed with it.
Right.
And yet there, a lot of other countries are just like, oh my God, that's terrible. They would never really be doing that. I'm not saying Japan's one of them, but there's definitely a different view from abroad.
Right.
So I think with Japan, it's quite the same thing, is that they enjoy doing some quirky things, and it's just something that, that a lot of people have clicked into. And it's, yeah, it's got a lot of its own unique culture. But I think you could probably do, if people clicked into that side of America, I think they could get it too. I mean, not the same exact thing. But if you decided to take up, you know, let's say the topic of flies, for example, you'd probably be amazed at what people are doing with flies all around America, whether it be fly fishing or, you know, testing miracles with honey and bee bites, or, you know, which relates to flies. Or I think it's much ado about nothing in many ways, but it's okay too. And I think all of these, when people really push the limits, I think it's good. It's good for society. It's good for a culture. And even in the States, we've got these, you know, people like Rush Limbaugh, Larry King, who, you know, just go on these wild tirades about things. And, you know, when I go back to the States, I get so sick of that kind of stuff that's all over the place. But I was reading an article in The Atlantic recently. I think it was by James Fallows. And he was saying, but, you know, all of this is good because it pushes the standards and it pushes the limits of the culture.
Right.
And he's so right. In other words, you know, you can go to some of these repressed countries where you're not allowed to say anything. Or you can push the limits, find out what the limits are, and get people thinking on a different level. Get them thinking outside of the black box, you know?
Right.
And I think that's really good for a culture and a people. And I think it's good in Japan, too. I mean, there are people out, even in Japan, saying outrageous things, but I think it's okay. I think it's, yeah, it's healthy.
You've been in Japan for a long time now. When you go back to the States, what kind of things surprise you in the States? Like, what's the culture shock you get when you go back to the U.S.?
It usually starts on the West Coast because I fly into the West Coast.
Right.
And I'm always surprised at how kind of rude people are.
Right.
And I don't really necessarily mean it in a bad way. It's just a different culture. And it always takes me a few days to get used to it. But people can be quite nasty. I got on an Amtrak train once to go up into the mountains from San Francisco. And, you know, Amtrak doesn't really have the best record, right, of being on time or even being safe.
Right.
And so the train was going to be 2 hours late getting into Reno. And, oh my gosh, the passengers just started yelling at this poor conductor.
Right.
And then what surprised me even more was that he started yelling back at them. And I was just like, oh my God, someone's going to bring out a gun here.
Right.
But, and I was just like, you know, these people, they're just complaining. You know, they have no clue as to what the delay is for.
Right.
You know, or that it might be okay, or that, you know, something uncontrollable, or, and they're just giving this poor guy hell, and it's not his fault either.
Right.
So stuff like that is rather shocking.
Yeah, I remember the first month or so I was here, we had that Typhoon Roke that came through. And I was on the train, the Yamanote Line train, going back to my hotel at Shinagawa Station there. And I can't remember what station I was at, but it should have been, you know, a 15-minute ride. And it was about, I think it took 5 hours total to get down there. And I didn't really know what was going on. I just knew that the train suddenly stopped. And it wasn't moving. I was a little bit surprised that everybody was standing there totally silent for hours.
Yeah.
No one was getting off. No one was getting on. No one was saying anything.
It's so admirable, isn't it?
It was kind of spooky for me because I was like, what's going on?
Right.
You know? I mean, if that happened back in my hometown of Vancouver, people would be like, ah, what's going on? Start grumbling, you know, start making phone calls or whatever. But everyone was just standing there, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know whether to get off the train, stay on the train, or what was happening. But
yeah,
a completely different experience than what would have happened in the West.
Yeah, it's I find it very admirable. And I think that the longer you're here, the more you become more like that. and you just start accepting things when they happen that are out of your control. And you deal with them better because you realize that getting upset, it not only is it not going to help anything, but it's not going to help yourself either. There's no point getting stressed about things like that. Right. It's not healthy. So you just kind of, after a while, when you understand how the Japanese people work, and then you start learning from it, and then you slowly start changing the way you do things too.
Right.
It's very interesting, but I feel like I've learned a lot from the culture, and I feel like I'm a much better person now because of it.
A lot more patient?
A lot more patient.
Relaxed?
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, part of that's maturity, too.
Can you tell me about the Hadaka Matsuri?
Ooh, the Naked Festival
that
coming up.
You have in your book.
Yep. Yeah, it's in February.
Right.
In Okayama at
what is
the
this?
The Naked
is
Festival.
Is it like the Pride Parade that happens in San Francisco?
Unfortunately not. I think we could have one of those as well. But this is an ancient tradition, and there are actually, I think, about three Hadaka Matsuris in Japan. Okayama isn't the only one, but it's certainly one of the, you know, it's, well, I won't even say it's the best known because I don't know that that's true, but it's absolutely fantastic, and foreigners can take part in it if they want to also. The idea is it's a Shinto ceremony, and the neighborhood puts the men into groups. It's males do this, and they all wear a fundoshi, which is the Japanese-style underwear, the old one which wraps around kind of like the sumo wrestlers wear.
Kind of looks like a thong. Like if someone's never seen it, right? It looks like a kind of a, like a diaper thong.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you're trying to picture this in your head, and God knows why you would do that, but picture a bunch of drunken Japanese men running around in thongs.
Right. And the idea is they have to all end up at the Saidaiji Temple. And in there, they are going to try to get a hold of a lucky piece of wood, is basically what it is, which will bring them luck for the entire year. And there are like 3 to 5 of these that they throw out, the priest will throw out from the top and like the rafters. And so they've got this huge crowd of semi-naked guys below, and they're all trying to grasp this for the luck. And during all the time leading up to it, they're drinking lots of sake.
Right.
They're running around in the streets. It's February. It's very cold. It's often snowing.
Right.
And they are getting doused with cold water to purify themselves.
Right.
And they're running around going, washoi, washoi, washoi. And they're just having a blast. And, you know, just watching them is so fun. And you just get all caught up in it. And there's always a group of foreigners.
Really?
And yeah, yeah, and anyone, as long as they get in, you know, their name and their that they want to participate early enough, can be in that group. And that just adds another, you know, of course, fascinating part of it.
Right.
Is to be able to actually participate in something like that.
I haven't participated in that. I don't think I will. But I think I'll give that one a pass. But that's one of those things that I always find so funny about Japan, because, you know, you look at, like, the businessmen going around to work every day in Tokyo, and it's just such a reserved group.
Mm-hmm. You know,
they're all walking around in their black suits, and there's no talking on the train. And then on the flip side, you have this custom, this ritual where everyone runs around naked in a thong. It's just such a contrast. It's one of the things I love living here, is you have this amazing contrast that you can see every day.
Yeah, and that's where a lot of this culture comes up again, that you were saying before, that, you know, they have all these strange things here, and I think it's the level they take certain things to.
Right.
Is that, yeah, they when they have a hobby, it's just not something to do in their free time, it's something that becomes a part of their lives.
One thing I wanted to ask you is, in your book you mentioned that Japan is a nation ruled by cartoon characters.
Mm-hmm.
Where does this fascination with this cartoons, anime, everything that's cute, where does this come from?
Oh, it's got to, I mean, who knows? I don't really have all the answers to all my questions. but or nothing resolute anyway. But
I mean, this was a nation at one point was like a warrior nation, you know, right? The samurai were held in high regard, and everyone was diligent in their job and what they had to do. It's hard for me to picture back then them being into kawaii goods. But nowadays, it seems like everything has to be kawaii.
Yeah, well, I think that's the modern Japan, indeed. And I certainly, you know, in the States, we wouldn't be the same as we were in the movie Gone with the Wind, you know, during the Civil War.
Right.
But now people, again, it's a part of that throwaway society. We have everything and we can concentrate. We have time now to concentrate on what is cute or to make things that we couldn't before. And I think if anything, it's just a sign of the excess in society, that people have so much now that and look at the arts, for example. The arts always flourish in a good economy. Mm. And when the economy gets bad, the arts are the first thing to go.
Right.
So I would put that up there with that kind of thing, that creativity that is allowed to happen, the risks that are allowed to be taken when the economy is up and people are well off.
I always find it funny when I see like some, you know, conservatively dressed businessman on the train pulls out his mobile phone and he's got all these little anime characters hanging off of it, you know?
I love it.
It's great.
One thing that always is funny to people on the island is that people come to Shiraishi Island, where I live. They come to the beach. It's mostly Japanese people. And you'll get these big old guys with the tattoos all over them. And and they'll head out into the water with a bright pink swimming ring around them.
Really?
And people are just like, that would never happen in the States because you're supposed to be manly and you're supposed to not, you know, need those things. And here it's just all part of the kawaii lifestyle.
You mentioned that you live on the island. It's called Shiraishi Island. Can you tell us a bit more about that? I find it interesting that your island has a population of less than 700 people.
That's right. It's at 624 right now. Unless someone should die in the next week, which is likely, because most people are over 60 years old.
How did you end up there? When you moved to Japan, is that where you moved to?
No, definitely not. When I first came to Japan, I came to do my teaching practicum. I was doing my master's degree and ESL, and I came to Japan to do a six-month teaching practicum at the university. And then while I was doing that, I got offered a full-time job at a different university. So I took that, and then I lived in Okayama City for 4 to 5 years. And then I went out to visit the island one day, and I just liked it so much. And I saw a side of Japan that I wasn't seeing in Okayama City or any part of Japan that I had been so far. And I just thought, wow, I'd like to try living here. And so I just moved there within a couple weeks, actually.
And for those of the audience who don't know, can you describe your island a little bit? Because I was looking at it online, and I was surprised to see that you have, like, one street. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's one road that goes all the way around the island. It's about 5 kilometers.
And you have, what, one grocery store?
We do. It has four aisles. It has just the basics. Most people who live on the island grow their own food. Now, they don't eat meat, so they don't have cows and stuff, but they grow most of the things. They do a lot of fishing. They're self-sufficient.
Right.
And it's the Japan of 100 years ago, and it's delightful, absolutely delightful. The people are great. The lifestyle is good and healthy. Yeah, it's an amazing place, and it's very accessible, for that matter. The inland sea islands are still undiscovered as far as foreign tourism goes, and for the people who have, the foreigners who have been to any of the islands in Japan, I mean the smaller ones outside of the four main islands, most people have been to Shodoshima, but Shodoshima, again, has, you know, a large population, certainly over 20,000 people, so it doesn't, it's still an island and has its own island culture, but the smaller islands are that even on a very, very microscopic scale. But one thing I learned is that each island actually has its own culture that's different from the next island. And traditionally, and even now, really, the islands don't mix much. You would think that, you know, especially back in the day when there wasn't all this transportation and stuff, you'd think that people would be quite interested in the island right next door and just take a boat and go over there. But that historically hasn't been very true. And now, of course, Japan is putting in lots of bridges to these smaller islands. And, you know, which is fine. It's certainly good for the islands because it brings them, you know, an economy that they never had before because people can now drive there. And so they need more stores and petrol stations and stuff. But it destroys the culture at the same time.
Right.
It's no longer unique.
Right.
And then you have, you know, your outsiders coming into the island. And, you know, it's just, it's fine, it's okay, it's just, but it'll never be the same again.
Right.
And Shiraishi actually is part of the Kasaoka Island chain. There are six islands in that chain. And they did want to put a bridge in at one time, but the islanders protested. They said, we don't want a bridge. And that's why we've been able to maintain this kind of pristine lifestyle, if you'll allow me to call it that. That is largely uninfluenced by the mainland. And people just lead a very healthy, down-to-earth life, and they love their island. They're not really interested in the mainland.
What was the islanders' reaction to you when you moved there?
Well,
were you the first Westerner to live there?
Yeah. And now, I have to say, though, that they were already used to Westerners because we have an international villa on our island that was started by the government over 20 years ago. And it was built especially for foreigners to be able to come out and see the countryside of Japan, which at that time was billed as the real Japan.
Right.
And so they love foreigners. They had good experiences with these people coming out. The international villa only holds 10 people at a time.
Really?
So, yeah.
I take it there's no McDonald's there, is there?
Yeah. And so when people do come to visit, I think they like it because it's a place where you can go to the local one bar and you can sit down with the Japanese people and you can talk to them and you can try out your Japanese. And even if you don't know any Japanese, people are happy to share a beer with you. It's, you know, they haven't really been spoiled or, you know, like a lot of people complain about Kyoto, how they're not so friendly towards tourists because right. they've been inundated.
Right.
Whereas Shiraishi isn't like that, but they have just the right mix. They've been around foreigners enough to be able to bend the rules for foreigners when they need it. You know, like if they need a Western toilet.
Right.
Or if they need a bed and cannot sleep on a futon.
Right.
Then they're willing to make those allowances.
Right.
But at the same time, they're not too used to foreigners that they're tired of it.
Right.
So it's rather unique in that aspect. So when I moved there, it was, you know, people were really open. And because I was working for the Japan Times then, it like to them, they saw it as an opportunity. It's like, hey, you know, we can invite her into our small circle, our like ancient Shinto ceremonies that we've been doing for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years. And she'll write about them in the Japan Times, and we'll bring a new aspect to people's understanding of Japan and the culture. So I found myself getting invited to these bizarre rituals and stuff, things that, you know, normally women aren't allowed to see or be a part of, and, you know, all these different things. And these secret ceremonies, and it was absolutely fantastic. And one time, I mean, there are lots of ceremonies on the island, still very traditional. And I suppose the sad thing is that in another 20 years, maybe even before then, all these rituals will have died.
Right.
Because the young people, of course, have all moved away from the island because there are no jobs. People don't really want to, you know, be commercial fishermen anymore.
Right.
They want to, you know, they go off to college and they want good jobs and, you know, be CEOs and things like that, more power to them. But the old people are left on the island, and they're keeping up all the traditions that they really believe in. And I think this is a big difference between the island and the mainland is the mainland mostly continues their traditions because of, you know, it's economics.
Right.
It's good for the economy. It's good for tourism. People can set up their stands and, you know, sell their, you know, American dogs, okonomiyaki, you know, all those things. But on the island, things are done because the people actually still believe in the rituals.
What do you think the future is for some of these Japanese islands? In 20 years, will they just be completely abandoned? What will happen?
That's what's happening already. There are about 200, you know, 250 islands in the Inland Sea, depending on what you actually call an island. And I've been to about 47 of them, and some of them have been completely abandoned. And you just see old houses where people used to live, and it's very sad. They could do a lot about it, but the government just doesn't really see things in the same light as like a Westerner's perspective. You know, a lot of us come to these islands, we think, wow, now here's a business opportunity.
Right.
But the Japanese, you know, for their own reasons, don't really think in that way. And when you consider that most of the island residents are over 60, they're at the time where they just want to sit back and drink beers for the rest of their life, you know?
Right.
They don't want to, you know, start up tourism and businesses where they're going to have to work.
Right.
So they would rather spend their time and money on, you know, refurbishing their houses, making a beautiful Japanese-style house, you know, replacing all the things that are falling down. And, you know, some of them really have a nice lifestyle right on the beach. And, you know, they go out and have their coffee out in front of their house and watch the sea and stuff. And so you can hardly blame them. But there's also a sector of the island that's very worried about their disappearing culture. And what we're trying to do is they've come to me and my husband, because we're the only Westerners on the island, and they are hoping that we can help bring some more tourism to the island. So we started working with them for a few years now and trying to get more foreigners to come to the island, and it's working. Mm. And we now have not just the International Villa, but we book foreigners into all of the traditional Japanese-style minshukas on the beach, and are trying to offer things that people can come and see and experience on the island that they can't get on the mainland. And just like I was saying, the great thing about the Okayama Hadaka Matsuri is that you can participate in it. On the island, they welcome people to participate all the time. So if we're having our fall festival and someone just happens to come to the island for the day, you can just jump right in, and they'll be happy to have you come and share part of their culture with them.
Right.
So it's really a unique place in that that people are so open and friendly, and that's what we're trying to have as our appeal to foreigners, is to come to a place where they'll be welcomed and taught about the culture, and they can participate. And also, while they're there, they can go to the beach, they can take a boat ride around the islands, they can go sailing, they can go see kayaking and, you know, hiking as well.
So there's lots to do on the island. It's just getting the word out, I guess, is a little bit difficult.
Yeah, but I think we're quite happy with the growth that we've experienced over the past few years. And we can't really handle a huge, big promotion and a bunch of people coming out
right.
at the same time. So it's been growing slowly but steadily, and that's been very comfortable. Every year we have a lot more people than the year before. It's still a place where especially expats come out and they're like, oh my gosh, wow. They're like, why didn't we ever know about this place before? Because you just feel like it's your own island, because
right.
there aren't that many people there.
Right.
And although we have a lot of Japanese tourists, they basically just come on the weekends. And in the summertime, and any other time you're there, you're going to have the place to yourself, the whole beach to yourself. You know, it's really nice. It's a relaxing place. But we also don't have discos and convenience stores. And, you know, so it might be a good for a few days for some people, but probably not longer.
You do have a bar, though. Tell us about the Moo Bar. Is it the only bar on the island?
Well, there are two.
Well, there's two. And now you have competition.
Oh, yeah. Sanshan's is a bar and restaurant, and that's
right.
open year-round.
Right.
And it's really the only business other than the International Villa that is open year-round. And then there's the Moo Bar. Moo as in cows.
Right.
And we are a beach bar, and we're right next to Sanchan's, and we're kind of a cooperative. So it's an island thing. Many people benefit from the profits and what goes on at the Moo Bar. It's not, you know, just mine.
Right.
Because that was one of the things we wanted to do, and my husband and I started it. We thought, okay, we want this to be something that everyone can be involved in and benefit from. So sometimes it appears to be a gaijin bar. And that's just because there are more gaijin on the island than foreigners or Japanese at that time. And there are other times when it seems to be like, why aren't there any foreigners there? Hmm. So, but it's a place where people can rock up and, you know, a lot of Japanese people are there as well, and they can talk to the Japanese and stuff. And the Japanese love talking to the foreigners, and we have a lot of local people from the island who, you know, come to the Moo Bar just for that as well, just because they just are fascinated with the way we act and the things we do. and we are equally fascinated with the things that they do and the way they act, and that's part of the fun of, you know, running the Moo Bar, is you're just always caught between these two cultures, neither of which you know as well as you think you do.
Right, right. I think the islands represent such a unique aspect of Japanese culture that most tourists won't see if they just stay in Tokyo or stay in Kyoto. I think the opportunity to get out probably will give you like a more realistic experience of what it's like to be in, you know, Japan. Because one of the things that many people have said is that one of the joys that they get in living in Japan is the Japanese people. But I think if you stay in the city, you actually kind of miss out on that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you come out to some of the islands, you can get a more personalized experience.
That's very true. And we happen to be in a really good location. We're a bit lucky because we're in this island chain, but we're the first island out. And so it doesn't take quite as long to get to our island as some of the other islands in the chain, which are also fantastic, and I would highly recommend. You know, Manabe Island, which is two islands away from us, is also a great place and has some restaurants on it. Not all the islands have anything, so it's good to check before you go.
Right.
But we're right between Osaka and Hiroshima, so we're kind of on the tourist path route. So when people are coming from Osaka, they can take the train and they can get off at either Okayama, or if they have a rail pass, it's best to go all the way to Fukuyama and then get off the train there and take the local train backtrack three stops to Kasaoka. Right. And then from Kasaoka, you walk a short walk to the ferry terminal and get on the ferries there. And there are plenty of ferries going all the time. And so it's a good, like, people, they, you know, often feel templed out after Kyoto and stuff, and they're heading to Hiroshima, and they'll take a few days to relax on the island and then move on.
Tell us about your next book that you have coming up. It's a pilgrimage about your experience doing the 88 temple tour. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, the Shikoku 88 Temple Pilgrimage. The title of the book really hasn't been decided. As a working title, I'm using Running to Nirvana on Japan's 88 Temple Shikoku Pilgrimage. And it's a story about me doing the Shikoku Pilgrimage, which, if you don't know about it, it's the most famous pilgrimage in Japan. It's over 1,000 kilometers long, or 900 miles, and it takes about 6 weeks to walk. Now, not everyone walks it. You can bicycle it in 10 days. You can take a bus and a bus tour, or the Japanese tend to do it that way. Or you can drive. A lot of Japanese people also drive. Most foreigners walk it because they just want the experience of how everyone used to do it, you know, from like 100 years ago on for, you know, 1,000 years.
Right.
People have been doing this. So it's fantastic, an amazing experience. Shikoku is untouched. Although there is a bridge that goes over to Shikoku now, for a long time there wasn't. Not until that Seto Hashi Bridge went over, and I think it was 85. So it doesn't have all those big cities and stuff that you have on the mainland, and so it's different. And when I did it, I did it because the Buddhist priest on my island had recommended it. Hmm. And the pilgrimage is Buddhist. But he told me, you don't have to be Buddhist to do it. Anyone can do it in any sect of Buddhism. Hmm. And lots of people in Japan do it. Everyone's heard of it and everyone wants to do it. And it's the type of thing that they dream of doing when they get older and have more time. Right. Most Japanese people don't have 6 weeks to take off and do that. And I happened to have 6 weeks off and I decided to do it, but I decided to run it because I'm a runner.
You ran it? Yeah. Oh, really?
It took me 5 weeks and I jogged about 6 hours a day.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it's written, of course, in a very light style because I can't seem to write any other way. And I just learned so much about Japanese culture on that pilgrimage. And I had already been here 5 years. And I realized how much I didn't know. And, of course, then I had all these other problems, you know, blisters and, you know, sore knees and and trying to sleep outside and bus stops.
Did you do it by yourself? But, you didn't have support crew or anything like that?
Not at all.
Wow.
And I was a bit naive at the time, you know. I didn't even think of those things. But, yeah, I was better off for it in the end.
Right.
The fact that I even made it was a miracle. Of all the problems I had. But it was really good. And I was lucky because I had a mentor who was the Buddhist priest. He's one of, you know, my best friends. And he helped me through the whole thing. And of course, but the island, I was telling you before about these traditional ceremonies and stuff. And we have a lot of Buddhist traditions as well. And so I had lived on the island and had seen all these ceremonies before, but hadn't really put it all together.
Right.
And when I was on the pilgrimage is when I was able to connect all these events with Buddhism and the meaning of them all.
Hmm.
And so that was really great. And I learned, of course, a lot about myself because it's always a personal journey when you do the pilgrimage. Right. Whether that's what you set out to do or not doesn't matter.
Right.
And so it was an amazing experience, and there's not enough literature out there about the pilgrimage in English. Nothing right now, actually. Oliver Statler wrote a classic book on the pilgrimage, but it's been out of print for quite a while. And so this is the first thing that's going to be out in a long time. There's a huge market for it. And also it's trying, like where Statler really wrote more of a book about the history of the pilgrimage, I'm writing about how it is related to the Japanese culture and the Japanese people today.
Right. Wow, that sounds great. I'm looking forward to reading that. And if people want to find out more about your current book, Japan Funny Side Up, they can find that on the Amazon store. It's available as a Kindle download. And also check out Amy's column in the Japan Times called Japan Light. Thanks, Amy. Thanks for coming on the show and giving us an insightful look at the islands of Japan.
Well, thank you very much. It's been really fun. And I hope that any of our listeners would never hesitate to come out to Shiraishi Island and see a bit of the other side of Japan. And I look forward to seeing you there, Anthony.
Oh, definitely. I will definitely be there.
All right. Thanks so much for this opportunity.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thanks again to Amy Chavez for coming on the show. You can check out her book, Japan Funny Side Up, on the Amazon store. It's available as a Kindle download. If you're planning on heading to Shiraishi Island and you want to check out the Moo Bar, do a search for moobar.com. And that's moobar.com. And I will post a link to that from my website at tokyopodcast.com in case you forget to add an extra O. Don't forget to check out 25 Cafes, your best travel guide to 100% smoke-free cafes in Japan. And Brad will be back in the following weeks to give us another fantastic review of the cafes that he finds in Tokyo. That's it. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Anthony Joe, and bye-bye.